Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Racer's Mindset. I'm your host, Brad Gebhardt, with me on the line for every single one of these episodes. It's been an amazing journey so far. He is an absolute expert on the motorcycle as well as the human body because he trains himself to be an elite athlete in his own right. Andrew Hopson, otherwise known as Hoppo. Hoppo, how's it going?
Good, Brad. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing just fine. And we've got a very, very special guest. Thank you so much for asking. He is knowledgeable, he's notorious, and he's now on Racer's Mindset. It's his first time on the show, but I have a feeling he's going to be a repeat offender. Welcome to the show from Complete Racing Solutions, Coach Rob Beams. How's it going, Rob?
Hey, guys. Thank you so much, and I appreciate that intro. I love the way that you said, hey, we might just be partners in crime here. Count me in 100%. Andrew knows better than anybody. If it comes to stirring the shit pot, I'm going to be one holding the stick for sure.
Yeah. Fair enough. Absolutely. And actually, Rob, you first came on the scene with me with some actually very impactful podcasts that actually I actually messaged you about probably about 6-7 years ago, which you did with the DMXS radio guy, David Iser, the kind of the two of you guys that did it. Like, oh, it's got to be like you did a better part of maybe 25 episodes, tackling different things, nutrition, just good habits, sleep. Like you really ran the gamut. And honestly, if those are still archived or found somewhere, they are extremely good tools. There's a ton of great information in there. I'm sure you haven't forgotten it, so you can probably regurgitate it again. but I guess what I'm trying to say there also is you've been doing this for quite some time. You've been an expert within this field, not only in fitness and nutrition, but also working with motocross racers for quite some time.
Yeah, I'm going to show my age here. Andrew and I tease about this off the record all the time. I just turned 55, and it seems like just yesterday. Anybody who's heard me previously, they know my first motorcycle is a 78 RM80 with the steel tank and the dual rear suspension with 6 inches of travel.
Love it.
And I'm still an absolute avid fan of the sport. I don't think you'll find a crazier fanboy than myself. I get off on the silliest things, like just yesterday, depending on when people watch this, yesterday on social media, on Instagram, I posted the 2-page spread of the 1980 YZ80 that was made by DG with the gold radial head, the gold swing arm, the tank. And, you know, for nowadays, kids look at that and go, ah, it looks so old. I remember having that thing on my wall.
It looks just cool.
Just salivating over it. Oh my goodness. It just had the best of everything. Even the stands, right? It was the kind that you had the wheel and it's kind of like the street bike ones. You wheel it underneath it and it lifts the tail end. And then they had the two hooks on the bar. You pull it forward so the bike's suspended. To me, that's still Macarena cool. You know what I mean? So no, I have been in the sport a very long time. And even though I got into it as early as my first race bike was a 78, but, you know, getting into it professionally with the Toyota TMX Moving Forward program, that was when we really jumped in with both feet. If you've heard that conversation before, Brad, I just realized I didn't want to get too deep into the sport. Cause as you guys know, once you get in the sport, it can kind of take some of the luster out of it. And so I fought it. I fought it hard for probably 10 years. And, I had the same thing happen in the triathlon realm where you couldn't go to a triathlon without somebody saying, hey, can you get me an entry into Ironman Hawaii? Or can you get me a heart rate monitor? And back then, the bar category wasn't big. We only had power bar. And because I was in the grocery industry, people are like, hey, can you get me some power bars? And on the coaching side, can you get me a heart rate monitor? I was like, man, this kind of sucks. I just want to go to the race and race, not be hit up for free swim advice and all the – I don't want that to sound harsh. I don't mind helping people if I'm there to do that. But when I'm there to race, like Andrew and I have talked about, you want to be incognito in the corner, just – let's go race, man. You know, sure. So
any update on my heart rate monitor though?
It's in the mail. You know how this sport says everything's in the mail. We'll it's stick with that. Mail. How's that?
And I want to, you know, when you talk about the RM80, you know, I'll date myself here as well, cause we're roughly the same age, but, and I've said it many a times on with Brad and on the podcast. It's like, hey man, I grew up on an island. Everything was shipped in. So by the time I got that motocross Action magazine with that in there, cause I had the same picture. It's like, you guys were already it was 3 months. We're always 3 months behind, you know, it was motocross Action, Splash, mountain bike Action, right? You know, all those.
Yeah.
Like, we were always behind. So, and you were just cover to cover on that thing.
Oh.
I think everyone had that DG poster on their wall. I did. So I'm dating myself.
And, well, and then you'd have the stack of motocross action, dirt bike, even dirt rider, even though it wasn't as cool, you know, it wasn't as heavy. Remember when the 1-800 came out and you could call in and get race results? First, it was
1-900 pro race.
1-909 pro race.
Yeah, 1-900 pro race. That's it. I remember that.
Yeah. Then it was like a dollar a call or something. I remember my dad going, what the heck is this bill? You know, what is he's, you know, cause they didn't have the adult lines then, but you have these new bills on your phone when you had phone bills. My dad, I remember him saying, what is this? I'm like, well, I want to see if Mike Bell won, you know, the Coliseum on Saturday night. And my dad was into racing, but he was just like, I don't think so. I mean, probably telephone bill was $13 a month.
And I had $82
on there.
In first place from Mission Viejo, California.
Exactly. Yep. And you're getting charged by the minute, as you know. And I tease about that. People remember when McGrath was running the 1-800 collect. Today's kids would go 1-800 who for what? Yeah, for call sure. Collect. What do you mean?
Well, there was a time when you had to put money in and see if someone would answer the phone for you.
And boy, you had to talk quickly because you were paying by the minute. You got your point across.
If you called your parents, I would call collect. And when they said, like, say your name, they're like, dad, pick me up.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you declines the call and comes, picks me up wherever I was.
Or what the kids don't remember is call and collect. And then your parents decline the call because you're late. I had that happen a couple of times.
Fair enough.
I was like, okay, this is going to be a rough, I wasn't going to get beaten when I got home, but I got spanked pretty bad.
Probably.
With that 1-800 collect, when I first went to American Honda in 99, there were still old box fans there where they'd ripped the stickers off. They'd been buffed. But that 1-800 collect was just still not as faded as the black paper paintwork. So it was around forever.
Yeah. So. Well, I am showing my age, but I do love the sport, and I'm still as much of a fanboy today as ever. One of the things I'm just thankful for is meeting guys like yourselves. You know, it's people who are just salt of the earth, love racing, could still sit over a cold pitcher of beer and bench race literally for hours. And, it could be something that we all three of us saw on the TV, but we could bench race for an hour.
Yeah. I mean, I raced motocross on Saturday. I went to Glen Helen, did four motos. I want to say thank you to you because you're a guy that I approached as a coach. You helped me. You've trained me. You somewhat guided me to where I am now, to where I am. I mean, we had some very in-depth conversations and, I give it all to you, but then I look back, it's like, yeah, well, I did the work as well. So it goes hand in hand, right? Like, you know, we had conversations. Why don't guys wear heart monitors? Like, they're paying me to train. I'm like, it's like, I don't get that side of it. So, but when you look back, I mean, you have your elite groups. You train some BMX guys. You got triathletes. You got moto. You got guys in GP. Is there any other aspects that, or,
you diversify your athletes?
Yeah. Or, I mean, like when you look at all those guys and you look at all their programs, like, you know, we would go into the back end of Garmin, look at stress and sleep and everything else to determine, are all those programs similar, the same? Or you go, hey, you're a road cyclist or you're a triathlete, we're going to break this up. But I think some of all the parameters are still the same, right? We're always looking at sleep, stress, resting heart rates and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, when you look at performance, really keep it super, super simple. Keep it in three silos. Where's the athlete at as an individual? Where is it that they ultimately want to get to? And how much time do we have in between? Because when somebody comes and presents themselves, you could have somebody as young as a PW50 rider with a parent that wants to make sure that the child, you know, they don't understand heart rate and nutrition. I know that may sound crazy to somebody who may be listening, but a lot of the parents it's not that they're trying to put their PW50 rider on a training program. They just want to make sure that they're evaluating the criteria, sweat rate, calories, sleep. I mean, same stuff that a vet rider needs. And selfishly for me, and that's why I appreciate the opportunity to be on any podcast that I can get on. Selfishly, if I could get to a parent who has a young rider, and that, can you imagine your young rider hearing something, Andrew, that you and I worked three specific years on? Can you imagine having that information at 11 years old? Parents deciphering the info, filtering it through the child on an as-needed basis, but the parent becomes the individual who can keep the athlete from smoking the adrenals, over, quote-unquote, overtraining. That's a tad bit of an adulterated word nowadays, but back in the early 80s when you literally, you had to take and download all your heart rate data into an Excel spreadsheet and actually had to plot everything on your own. It wasn't that long ago, as much as we joke about it, right? So Andrew, like you say, when someone's not willing to wear a heart rate monitor because they say it's too complicated, I'm like, you just simply wear it. Everything else is digitally caught. You know, even if you invest in the digital scale, you don't even have to manually put in your body weight. So the ease of information is there. The problem is the interpretation and the understanding of it. Andrew, you know yourself in the cycling background, how many people train with power meters, race with power meters, and don't know how to interpret the data?
I mean, I ended up with a new road cycle this year, a Felt, which come mm-hmm. with a power meter. So that has been a learning curve for me as well, right?
Yep.
And then like this year, I really dove into the cycling and the road cycling, you know, cycling with groups on Saturdays. And, you know, there was a couple of weeks there. I did like 200 miles a week.
Yes. Right?
But for me, it was more of a beta test. I'm like, what can I do? Because we live and die by the Garmin app. Like I knew where my sleep was. I knew stress. I knew all that, but I was like, what can I do at my age? What can I get away with? Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that they're important things to definitely monitor. And, you know, and as I got deeper into the cycling side, like I'm listening to these guys because now I'm riding with some pros and, you know, they're cool guys and you're in a line and all that stuff, we know. But then they just kept saying, I'm at 19. And I'm all, what are you talking about? No, mm-hmm. I'm at 19 hours. And I'm all, I'm at miles. No. You got to go off the hours. And then, you know, then they're breaking down all the power meters and that sort of stuff. So, you know, that's been another learning curve, which I really liked as well.
And it's funny you say that because when your initial question is, are the programs somewhat similar? They mm-hmm. are from a terminology known as periodization, preseason, right. Pre-competitive, mm-hmm. competitive phase one and two, off-season, right? I think I forgot one. You'd have preseason, pre-competitive, competitive, and then the off-season. The biggest thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to establish athletic durability, and that can only come through miles. So when you, Andrew, received your schedule, and we knew that, okay, we're in phase number one, you could take literally the first 2 years of anyone's schedule that I've worked with. You take my triathlete, you take Andrew, you take Brad, and you lay those out. There's going to be a tremendous amount of similarities because strength training is strength training. Building a strength base is building a strength base. And then understanding and identifying where the physical and mental limiters are at. So yeah, some people can say, oh wait, there's a lot of similarities between your professional cyclists, your professional motocrossers, your amateur cyclists, and your triathletes. Yeah. Because there's a principle that has to be established. Where it becomes interesting, and I know some of the listeners are going to choke at this, you start getting to around year number two, and now what you have is a framework. So when you talk about hours, without boring the listener to tears, every week that I write a schedule, I reverse engineer the total amount of hours. We subdivide it into aerobic and anaerobic, and then like in moto, we divide it between on the motorcycle first and then off the motorcycle second. So if you're somebody who can only ride on the weekends, now, again, I don't want to split hairs and bore the listener to tears. By the time you get to Friday, most programs out there have you exhausted by Friday, and then you're going to go jump on the motorcycle and wonder why you keep getting hurt or you're getting burnt out physically or mentally.
Yeah. There's nothing left on Saturday when I went to go ride because I torched myself Monday through Friday.
But the hard part is they want to be fit on the bike on Saturday. So it only makes logical sense that I should work hard Monday through Friday, not realizing cumulative fatigue stacks. Then when you get on the bike, the risk of injury goes up without getting into a lot of blood chemistry. Right. When your blood sugar levels are low, your depth perception of speed is negatively impacted. So here you are, you're tired. You're so damn excited to go get on the dirt bike. You haven't really eaten because life gets in the way. You get to the track. Think about it. If you ate dinner at 6 p.m. and you're geared up and starting to ride at 10, you know, start thinking about that. That's 16 hours since your last ingestion of food. Your blood sugar is going to be pretty depleted.
Right.
So now you're frustrated.
Most people don't like to ride on a full stomach. I'm one of those people. I felt the same thing with hockey. I use hockey as an example often because I played hockey. Sure. I played 50 plus games of hockey a year, even as a 35-year-old.
Okay.
And I will avoid eating within probably 2 hours of anything heavy within 2 hours of playing because I just don't like that feeling of just like kind of like either burping up your food or just that heavy feeling in your stomach.
Yeah.
A lot of riders are very, very similar, especially because of how demanding moto is like, I think I've heard you talk about this, is essentially like, it's so demanding that it basically takes like the digestion gets put on pause.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, it's just, it's a negative feeling for a lot of racers. So.
See, I can, and with working with Rob from this, I was exactly what you were, but I have now trained myself over the years to where we talk about, you know, 1,000 calories in a morning. I'll just use it as 1,000 where, mm-hmm. you know, exactly what you said. I had a big meal on Friday night, got everything ready. Saturday morning was up 4:30 or whatever, which is a long day. You know, I'm trying to get 1,000 calories in, whether mm-hmm. I'm still kind of just sipping on stuff, getting into the track. And then as we know, we've got race fuel, we've, you know, our calories, and we're just topping off through the day.
Sure.
You know, whether that's a handful of muffins and eggs and oats or whatever, it's like, I'm over that part of, oh, I feel uncomfortable with a full stomach. Again, a couple of weeks ago, I raced, toured a Big Bear on a bicycle. Same thing like it. We ran to this Airbnb and there's people in there and I'm all, you guys aren't eating enough for breakfast. Like, you know, I'm just trying to nearly sick just eating bananas and muffins, but I knew in 2 hours, for the next 2 to 3 hours, I was good. I'm just sipping and just topping off.
So. And Brad, that's where you're already ahead of the curve, because the magic number is 2 hours. You heard Andrew say the same thing. He's up at 4, 7:30.
Where did
time.
I mean that?
Yeah. Well, and to elaborate on what you're saying, people don't realize digestion requires blood and it requires water. And then when you start to bring your heart rate up, now you put the body into what we refer to as the hierarchy of needs. It's going to make an executive decision to either dissipate heat by distributing blood to the muscles for oxygen and nutrients and water to the skin for sweating, exothermic process, and or digest food. Well, it can't do both.
Yeah.
So what it says is, and it'll always be the number one choice, we're always going to worry about not dying of a heat stroke. So it's going to shut down digestion. Therefore, you either feel nauseous or you end up with loose bowel syndrome. The magic number is 2 hours, and this is where Andrew has worked extensively with smoothies and all kinds of combinations of food. That's the hard part that most people aren't willing to do. Now, I'm not saying this to embarrass Andrew because he's on the show, but that's one of the things that I love about people
even
who are just like,
embarrass Andrew.
Well, you know, it's like you're asking people to experience being uncomfortable to find out how far can we push that line. And you can train yourself as Andrew's done. The problem is people have to get comfortable being uncomfortable and then realizing, okay, I'm really uncomfortable. Okay. Tune it down one little notch.
Right.
I'm still feeling really bad. Pull it down another notch. Then you feel, oh, I don't feel good, but you don't end up running out of energy in a 2 or 3 hour bike ride like Andrew does.
Right.
And that's the magic. It was
like
number.
Progressive overload in the gym. Like I'm bench pressing 135. I put 10s on. Now it's 155. It's hard, but it's not great. Like, you know what I mean? Like if you put on a whole other plate, now we're all at 225. I can barely get a rep, if that.
Yep.
Dial it back to the point where it's manageable. And we're still performing at a higher level.
I just want to touch on something back there a couple of minutes ago when Rob said, you know, talked about processing speed and you know, your sugar and you know, making mistakes. And I guess like I've done a lot of bicycles this year, right? So now I've switched over. It's like World Vet's coming up. So everything for me now is all preparation for World Vet, which probably shouldn't try and cram that much in. I probably should have rode a little more moto in the year, but I like the race bicycles as well. But, you know, on Saturday morning, I went to Glen Helen, and you talk about processing speed. So I've jumped in these guys that have been racing moto all year, right? I've only ridden a handful of times. I raced the week before. I struggled processing speed. So when you said that, I went, but I know what I ate. I know what I had. And I knew where my calories were. So to me, it was more of, I've just raced so much bicycles lately that next from going from 20, 30 mile an hour, now I'm doing 50 mile an hour. So I had to flip that switch of processing speed. But then what you said then is like, that's something I need to go back and make sure that, you know, as the day went on, I actually did my fastest lap on the last lap of the last race. So I got better as the day went on, muscle memory come back.
Yep.
I mean, I think that is a good point as well. It's like, you know, you have to know those numbers and know what's in your system. Because as we've spoken many a time, I can race a bicycle, mountain bike or a road cycle, and I can carry nutrition with me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We get on a moto, like Brad said, you don't like, liquid calories are the best, the quickest to get calories in, and you're on the line, you're going to do a 20, 30 minute moto. It's like, you got to know what you're putting in. So much talent is only going to get you so far.
Well, there's always an inverse relationship between intensity and food complexity. That's why the proliferations of sports drink and energy gels and all that has come about. And again, it's always off the back of a triathlete because they're willing to try anything. What I think is interesting and what Andrew was just saying, you notice that he didn't have a problem with the muscular endurance. Well, that's because of all the miles. You notice that he didn't complain that his muscles gave up. That's muscular raw power. He's got both of those. Now you've got the perception of speed. And this goes back to what makes a weekend warrior, in my opinion, the most bad mofo at the track, because he has to literally take half a Saturday. I'm going to reiterate what Andrew just said. He's spending half of the morning getting himself back up, no pun intended, back up to speed. It's never a physical issue when you've got the foundation. It's getting that. If you and I are sitting here throwing a baseball, or Brad, you like hockey, you're sitting here. I've never been on ice skates in my life, to be honest with you, right? Assume that I could, and you and I are just going back and forth. And then a professional NHL guy shows up and he slaps that stick once. We won't even be able to stop it.
No,
it's the same. It's the same two sticks and the same puck. It's the same sheet of ice. It's about the ability to process speed. And that's what I want people to understand. Weekend warriors are the baddest mofos because you carry in the week of fatigue. You're trying to cross train so you can enjoy the weekend, but unfortunately they stack so much fatigue, it craters their ability to enjoy being on the motorcycle. And that's what, now we're back to the juggling act, and that's kind of our niche that we focus on. Foundation is foundation, right? And Andrew's probably tired of hearing me talk about this. Everybody thinks the only way you can build your sprint speed is by doing sprint intervals, and it's exact flip-flop of the opposite. If I were to give you $100 and I was going to give you a 65 or a 450, and I said, whichever bike gets there quicker, which bike are you going to choose? And everyone would say the 450, and I go, okay, why? And this exact same answer comes from everybody. It has more power. Okay, well, in the physiological world, doing sprint speed doesn't create power. It does, but at the superficial level, it does not. You have to build the foundation of strength, that's the size of your piston, your aerobic capacity and capillary beds, that's your carburetor. Well, now those two, that's where Andrew and I talk all the time. Everybody's trying to elevate their program when you're literally being held back. That's why we always use the analogy of a set of railroad tracks, strength-based aerobic engine. When those are developing on par with one another, you can raise the whole foundation. No pun intended, you're only as strong as your weakest link. So Andrew can now go do 17 motos at Glen Helen. That won't be the problem. It's the ability to process the speed, plain and simple. Now, the weekend warrior who doesn't do 200 miles a week on his bicycle, he's going to be on struggle bus on processing speed and not having the foundation, and wonders why he gets beat like a bad idea by Andrew. That seriously, that's what makes this. That's why I'm going to World Vets this year. And I can't wait because we've got so many athletes that are out there that are doing their racing, and to be able to sit there and watch them race and be able to talk about it a little bit more intimately because you're there. Right. Anybody can watch a race, but being there is a totally different animal.
Right. And Brad's actually coming down to race as well. So we'll all be there.
No, perfect. We'll do episode two, just shy of my birthday in November. Okay. You've worked with a lot of athletes, a lot of different athletes, athletes that have challenged you, athletes that have probably been easier to work with. What do you find is the linchpin to be able to communicate with an athlete, someone who you can really make those aha moments maybe a little bit more accessible than someone who I wouldn't say is closed off to it, but just maybe more difficult to communicate with?
I feel this is a privilege to meet you, Brad. Obviously we've text back and forth on DM and stuff like that, but I always say that it doesn't matter who I'm working with. I have to earn your trust. And the only way I can earn your trust is through results. Mm. And I think people, one of the questions I get quite often is, why do people give you so much resistance? Because so many people have been burnt by so-called trainers that don't know what they're doing. Mm. Just because you are a factory rider doesn't make you a physiologist and nutritionalist. Just like I'm no more equipped to be Mitch Payton's factory mechanic than an ex-pro should be a physiologist. But everybody gets out of their lane and they end up getting themselves slapped into the right lane eventually. The big thing for me is I'm not interested in trying to get to domino number 100. Let's start with domino number one. whatever that could be. If your pain point is cramping, we need to know, is that dehydration, electrolyte depletion, or is that maybe you're just putting too much load on the muscle and that's why your calves are cramping on a really rough track. It's always about trying to figure out, and this is something that's a real pet peeve of mine, is so many trainers make it about them. If I tell you not to eat dairy, no gluten, no red meat, and there's really no explanation, you have no adverse side effects to any of those, and you're telling me that you're anemic, is this about me or is this about you? Because I can make it really painful. Don't drink any water. Don't sleep at all, and make sure you train 22 hours a day. Now, if that makes you respect me, you know, I've teased Andrew about it. The more absurd I can make
I think worse than death, but okay.
Yeah. Well, if I put a program out, I said, you're not allowed to drink, you're not allowed to sleep, and you're not allowed to eat, I probably would be on a talk show on Monday and I'd probably have hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. And I say that very sincerely. My program is so simplistic and easy to follow, but, and Andrew's heard this dissertation 100 times. As soon as I'll give you, let me finish the sentence and I'll give you a real world example. As soon as you get results, people find a way to self-sabotage because they're petrified of success. Because if Andrew wins Big Bear, well, then he's expected to win Blackwater 100. Then he's expected by who? What I always say to my athlete is nobody wants to win worse than Andrew. So who gives a flying flip what anyone on the side has to say?
Right.
You go out there and you do what you need to do. Champions are motivated by the process of success. They don't get intimidated by the fear of the outcome. I have an athlete. He was training for a particular, I'll be very blunt. He was training for a marathon and he came from another program. They were running high mileage. His body fat percentage was going up. Speeds were getting slower. He was getting hurt all the time. He trains with us for, I think, only 4 months, 5 months. Runs his marathon and sets a PR by 18 minutes. And I get literally not a phone call. I got a text message that said, hey, set a PR by 18 minutes. Thanks so much. I'm going to go a different direction. That was the day of the race after setting a PR. So if you don't believe that people are petrified of success, that just goes to show you, okay, yep, we got the results that I wanted, but I don't want the pressure, air quotes, the pressure of keeping that up. What I like to flip the narrative is, do you understand how you slept better last night? Andrew and I've had this conversation. He could go through the whole combo,
yeah.
Right? If you didn't sleep well last night, let's talk about that. Okay. You slept really well last night. Can you tell me how you slept well last night? What contributed to it? Because when someone has a shit night of sleep, then they want to look at details. When they have a good night of sleep, and you can take the same thing to racing. Hey, good job. You won this weekend. How'd you do it? I don't know. I just won. Well, I can't duplicate, I don't know.
Well, I mean that, and through that, I can contest. I mean, you would say to me, why are these numbers where they are? And then that was when I worked out what alcohol did to my body.
Mm-hmm.
I love alcohol, but I hate what it does to me. I can't sleep. My HIV goes in the toilet and I don't perform. So then I gradually just pulled that back.
Yeah, but then how do we talk to women?
you just walk around with your finisher medal, Brad, like Andrew always does.
Yeah. 30 years ago, you had a phone book and you had to dial the number. That's how you had to do it. Yeah, or you went and watched the live band.
Charisma. Now they'd shorten it up, I hear.
Yeah. So, I mean, I live and die by the sleep, the HRV, and that dictates, as we know. I mean, that kind of sets a precedent for the week and what you can and don't do. I mean, like, I won 2 mountain bike championships this year. Even, you know, that was club day sort of stuff, but I still won the races. But exactly what you said, it was like, you know, every Friday leading up to the race, it's like, man, can I do it? Is that guy going to come back at me? He's a little better climber than me, you know, the elevation. Like, I text you about elevation. It's like, man, the one track just kills me on elevation.
Yeah.
And what can you do? I mean, I just had to go there and do the best I could. But I know that feeling. It's like, you know, it's like, can I reproduce that? Am I duplicating the week to a T I know what I'm going to do? Yeah.
Well, what's crazy is if you think about what the definition of overtraining is, it's simply not absorbing the work that you've done. So Andrew, you said earlier that you're biking 200 miles a week. That's not overtraining if you can get enough food, get enough sleep, and maintain proper hydration levels.
Right.
There's a literally, I being a past athlete at the Olympic Training Center as a triathlete and now as an elite coach, I still get all kinds of journals and clinical studies. And they had one that was done from the British Journal of Medicine. And it's now circulating around at the Olympic Training Center here in Colorado. And it's a study that's done on a symptom known as REDS. That's the acronym. Stands for Relative Energy Deficiency in Sport. Long and the short of it, as you can imagine, the expenditure of calories associated only with exercise is, I want to make sure the listeners understand it. So you guys let me know. The REDS, the symptoms, are a byproduct of the exercise calorie burn rate supersedes the food intake. And literally, as barbaric as it sounds, there's an insufficient amount of calories left for what they call just everyday life. We call it basal metabolic needs. How many calories do you need to stay alive? After the calorie expenditure of exercise, there's not enough to literally support the human body. So put it in numerical terms. You need 1500 calories a day to stay alive, basal metabolic needs.
Right.
You're burning 3000 calories. So you put those together, that's now 4500 calories, but you only eat 3000. What you need to stay alive, there isn't enough in the tank. And if you put it in mechanical terms, right? You guys invite me out, we're going to ride 320s at Glen Helen, and I come tootling up with a gallon of gas. You look at me like, dude, do you not know anything? Right? You'd seem like an absolute idiot. But yet people will go out and burn 3,000 calories and maybe bring a bottle of sports drink. They might bring a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. They might bring an apple or a banana. So that's where it becomes very, very daunting is like at Loretta's this year, we have one of our riders, Nolan Ford, and you start doing the math and the calculations, you're looking at almost 500 calories in a 20-minute moto. Yeah, wow. So stop and think about that. Now it's one thing when you've only got one moto per day, but that's a very young man. What about a vet rider, right? Mm-hmm. Calories per pound. We can get into watts per kilogram and all that kind of stuff. But the idea here is, can you imagine for those of you that run six motos in a day? Now they're not 20 minute motos unless you're racing pro, but let's just say that the calorie burn rate is 250. Well, next thing you know, that's now 1,000 to 1,500 calories on top of what you need to sustain life. Your last meal was at 6 o'clock last night. It's now 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you've had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And you wonder why you start with a bang and end with a fizzle at the track.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I, like anytime I've ever talked to anybody about taking on a new fitness regime is everyone wants to start moving more and eating less in the very same day. And like, that is an absolute recipe for disaster because like you're currently eating blank. And it's getting you through the day that you don't work out. Mm-hmm. Now you throw in a 60-minute workout and you're brand new to the workout regime. So you're going to put some extra mustard on that. And then, but you're at the same time, you're going to scale back on some of the, honestly, probably the most calorie dense foods that you would normally eat, like your junk food and stuff like that. So now you've stripped it down. You're eating a lot of your, like mentally, you're kind of like in this like sort of fight or flight system. Like area of like, I got to eat celery and broccoli and chicken breast. That's all I can eat. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, and then I also have to do like 60 wind sprints. And so your mind is on that all day long. You're not fueled enough and you're asking your body of more than you've been asking of it for months on end. And then you wonder why on like, you started that on Monday. By the time you get to Friday, regardless if you're racing the weekend, by the time you get to Friday, you are completely cooked and you're like, maybe fitness isn't for me. I'm not going to get like, you know what I mean? Like it can happen that fast. And it's no different than like, I find like there's a lot of people who are like, I'm going to start training 5 times a week. How about twice? Mm-hmm. How about and you want to do like, let's say 100% of a workout looks like this. Why don't we do 80 twice? And then we can break that into, let's do 75% 3 times. You know what I mean? Like, it's like,
yep.
Build up that, like, if you start out trying to train like a professional athlete while you also have a full-time job, that is like the most unsustainable thing that I can possibly think of is that like, you're going to ask yourself to train like Chase Sexton when you realize that Chase Sexton's never worked 40 hours a week in his entire life.
Yep.
Like, well, I was like, just talking to you. You know,
I was
I mean?
Just talking to Jake Masterpool this morning, and he's got Epstein-Barr. And again, I want to scream from the highest mountains. Epstein-Barr, chronic fatigue, Addison's disease, all of those are fatigue-related diseases that are now at a blood chemistry level. Don't let that sound sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Cells make up tissue. Tissue makes up organs. Organs make up a series of systems. Now you have a system. The entire human body is exhausted as a byproduct of, and it's just a constant stacking of one or a combination, chronic dehydration, chronic sleep deprivation, chronic food, insufficient calorie intake, right? The adrenals can't continue to do the fight or flight that you're referring to. Therefore, we get the word adrenal fatigue. They're stressed on the output. They're not getting high quality MCT oils on the input. Therefore, the adrenals, literally, if you can imagine a sponge that just dries up, peters out. People go, well, that's not relevant for me. Okay. You ever heard of Marchbanks? Have you ever heard of Seth Hanmaker? Have you ever heard of Ryder D? These are three people in real terms that have a disease that we're talking about that's a byproduct of insufficient calorie intake, insufficient water intake, high intensity interval training, HIIT training, not enough rest intervals in between. I mean, you could just keep stacking what would contribute to adrenal fatigue.
Yeah.
Epstein-Barr, Addison's, they're all fatigue related diseases. And it's always going to come back to, and Andrew said it earlier, he looks at sleep. And then the amount of sleep that he gets dictates how much stress, keyword stress, can he take on tomorrow. We want Andrew's stress to be on doing 10 by 1 mile hill repeats in a seated position, or maybe ever the one stands. But the problem is people don't realize insufficient calorie intake creates stress. Dehydration creates stress. Inadequate sleep creates stress, to the point that now we have an article at the Olympic Training Center about relative energy deficiency in sports. And it's all about insufficient calorie intake. It's sitting at the Olympic Training Center, and you've got so-called experts out here that are leading some of our most valuable and most expensive race teams, uneducated, and just saying you've got to be light on a 250. And hey, the last guy that was here that did it, he did it and he won a championship. Oh, how about we get him on the phone and let's take a look at, can he get an erection? Is he craving simple sugars? Does he have night sweats? Those are all external signs of adrenal fatigue. Right. Sure, he won a championship, but it's like you essentially are treating him like a greyhound dog. You got the championship for who? Oh, yeah, well, he got to cash that $1 million bonus. No, had nothing to do with that money. It was for the OEM who wanted, they didn't care if they used and abused and chewed up and spit out, because there's a laundry list of people who are one and done.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Think about it. That's what, like, I've never met Mitch Payton myself. I would love to meet him and shake his hand. But if I were him, I would be madder than a wet hen. Because if you go and you look at all those number one plates on his door, the only person that's duplicated it was Ricky Carmichael. Not one other person on that door ever won the championship twice. Shane Bentley never did it. Matt Walker never did it. I don't know all of them that are on there. There's a boatload of them.
Yeah.
But show me the two time.
Yeah, there's not a lot of guys that have multiple championships.
Or if there is, let me rephrase that. If there are doubles, I would say there's less than five. I would say I could count them on one hand.
I think there is.
There's Tedesco,
Bill Poto, Townley, Purcell.
Langston.
But they got two of them or one of them?
They got two. Like, okay. Bill Poto won the championship for Mitch all 3 years outdoors and has one 125 title. But Langston went back to back East Coast 2005-2006.
I think it's cool. And the reason why I ask is, in my opinion, every one of those guys, if Mitch signs somebody to a 2-year deal, the equipment is good, the rider's got his program dialed, he should be able to duplicate that. Mm. How many of those guys that Mitch got the championships for, or Geico, or Star, whatever, right? How many of those guys immediately went and became the next champion at the 450 level? Now, I'm not saying that it's easy to jump from 250 to 450, but I'm saying, like, give them 3 years. Okay, Villopoto is a good example, right? He did won all three for Mitch. When he went outdoors, and maybe he's probably not a good example because he did do extremely well when he went to the 450, but it's like, to me, that should be the pattern. And this is why I have an amateur development team that I own here stateside. I have one in the UK, And I have one in Australia for this exact reason,
yeah.
Because you're into hockey, right? So every little kid right now that's 7 years old wants to go to college and play hockey to get to the NHL eventually. Yeah. Well, where do we have it on the motocross side? My point being is I would expect to see a young athlete be top five in the super mini class, go top five as schoolboy one, schoolboy two, 250B. You're not going to win every race. I'm not insinuating that, but you should be in the hunt, top three, top five, as you go from class to class over a 6 year, 7 year build. You get handed off to a factory team. You should be catapulting. Unfortunately, show me one 250 team that had a rider that went into the 250 program that excelled. Now, again, if there's an exception to the rule, I'll be the first one to own it. But off the top of my head, if I think in the last decade of how many people won Loretta's, went into one of these 250 programs and immediately accelerated, and you cannot use Hayden Deegan because he went from futures directly in.
Right. No, the track record has not been good, especially even like they talk about the Madden curse. I think there might be a little bit of a Horizon Award curse because I think there's still a lot of meat on the bone when it comes to Ryder D, but he has struggled mightily as a pro. In the case of Ryder DeFrancesco, I feel like he hasn't put his feet down yet.
Well, think about the problem that he had, and this is not his fault, right?
Right.
You're on the best equipment from 65s to the 250B class at Loretta's. Fitness is not an issue. You're on the best bike. Nobody can touch you. Then when you go pro and everybody's bikes have a 2% discrepancy, all of a sudden now fitness becomes a prerequisite. The bikes are all the same. The playing field got leveled. Well, now he goes into panic mode that he's not in shape. So he gets trained into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, he should be really blossoming as a 250 pro. Unfortunately, he's beaten and battered and tired, and he's not meeting expectations. So you guys know what that does to the psyche, right? Like when I was working with AC, if I heard it once, I heard it a million times. He was referred to as baby Jesus, right? So like you go all the way through that. There was no other expectation for AC except to continue to win, even though I don't even think his balls had dropped when he first went to Mitch.
He was very slight. Like that, like even the, he had grown when he went, like the, when he grew
not that,
that year,
first
he,
year. Not that first year.
He was still tiny. He was very tiny. Yeah. Honestly, I guarantee
he was side saddling the bike.
28 pants.
Yeah. If you look at the bikes, I mean, he literally was side saddling it when he was not on the bike.
Yeah.
But then he finally grew, and then he got to a point that he actually outgrew the 250, which was a perfect fit for him to go 450.
Right.
But that's what I think is hurt Ryder is the equipment was always so good. And then when all of a sudden the equipment leveled out, now the fitness, the people who had put in the 5 or 6 years, like you said though, Brad, not smashing yourself, just training like exactly what Andrew is saying. Just consistency is the name of the game. But I look at this and I'm like, and this is why I do get on my soapbox. What parent out there whose son or daughter is in a super mini isn't thinking pro? Well, then why are you not planning to go pro? And I hear the excuses all the time. Well, the industry doesn't allow for it. You're only as good as your last race. Okay. Well, I don't know where you want to meet in that argument. I'm here to make sure that your athlete can go the distance. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, we do have to navigate the political landscape, which is very, very difficult. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But I've said this publicly and I'll say it on your show today. If I'm Mitch Payton and I've got all of these dollars invested in research and development, and I keep getting handed over athletes who are completely beaten and battered. I mean, no joke, all jokes aside, how many people does Mitch have signed for next year right now? Seven or is it six? Six or seven? Six. He's got the regular four, plus he's got
Masterpool,
thank you. And
Marchbanks came in.
Marchbanks is the new addition, but they kept the original four. So are they starting to match this star program? If we hire 37 people, we might get four people to finish the season.
Hope that people ignore the fact that one of the guys is, he started out fifth and went back to 19th. Mm-hmm.
I look at it from an investment standpoint. If I was a sponsor of Mitch's team, I would want to him to have good, healthy athletes. If I was Mitch himself, I'd want, if I was Cowie, if I was Geico Honda, if I was any of the OEMs and or the supporting people, right?
Mm.
And that's where I think there needs to be a paradigm shift is somebody needs to finally put their stamp down and go, why do we not have healthy athletes coming into the pro ranks?
Mm.
Well, because the amateur ranks chewed him up. Okay.
Yeah, there's so much pressure to perform there.
But see, every
by the time you get to the,
whenever I bring this up, people are like, oh, you're calling out X, Y, and Z. Take all the faces off the shoulders, stick to the conceptual conversation, the concept of the conversation. If an athlete is undereating and they're chronically dehydrated and you have all the symptoms and signs and you still keep plowing down that direction, and then you come back a year later and go, hey, guess what? XYZ rider now has Epstein-Barr. What am I supposed to say? I told you so. Because now the athlete's career is fucked. There's nothing that that athlete can do. Just during, you know, depending on when you listen to this podcast, a couple of weeks ago, we had a couple week break in between the outdoor nationals.
Right.
I had literally a half a dozen phone calls combining of both agents and riders that said, I'm exhausted. One guy had blood work. I have Epstein-Barr. What can I do? I said, sleep, eat, and hydrate.
Yeah.
And literally the response is, I don't have time. And the other response is, well, my bro network trainer told me that I have to eat no more than 1800 calories a day. I'm like, yeah, but your watch is showing that you're burning 34 to 38, sometimes 4,000 calories.
That's a deficit. That's a bodybuilder deficit.
But let me ask you this. When you go back to Star Yamaha, not last summer, but the summer before, do you remember when Jay Coop looped out on that uphill climb and he went out? Star Yamaha did not have one 250 bike on the track to the point that they had to bring in Chisholm because Monster was hitting them with such high financial ramifications, right?
Right.
So my point is, it's not about pointing fingers. All I'm saying is look back at history is all I'm asking you. Go ahead, Andrew. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was going to say, you know, going back to the touching on that again, and then going back to the nutrition side, like we talked about calories deficit. And we've had the same conversation with, you know, even, you know, everyone finishes at the track, you load up, you drive home, you don't eat, you get home, and then, you know, talk about the yellow pea, it's your body eating muscle, that's the protein. You know, there's still all the necessary nutrition after the race is done, whether it's bicycle, motorcycle, whatever. And it's like, and you said before, it's, you know, any food is good food at some point, whether it is Del Taco, whatever it is. But, you know, I had no residual soreness yesterday from racing four motos, and that was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
But like I said, I'm pretty regimented and I know what I eat and I know what to eat and when and where. So I mean, most people would do four motos and go, yeah, I'm really, really sore today and I couldn't move. But I went home and did an hour and a half on a cycle in zone two. But I knew if I didn't do that, I would be sore yesterday, right?
Yep.
But I think that the end of day nutrition is just as important as the nutrition of the morning.
Well, we always say that when the race is over, let's just say that you, like, let's take Loretta's. If you, when you get done with your race on Tuesday, first moto, as soon as you cross that finish line, the recovery stopwatch begins. So the, especially for those that get in impound area, it's difficult because it could literally be an hour by the time you get up there, give your speech, do all the stuff you're going to do, take pictures, do interviews. Well, Andrew, I apologize. This is redundant. You know this, but that first 15 minutes when you shut down the high intensity, you have a glycogen synthase enzyme. That enzyme activity is what facilitates the absorption of sugar. So you want to leverage that window of time. The hard part, you have two ends of the spectrum. You have a really good race. There's a lot of distractions. And if you had a shit race, you're so angry, you just want to punch somebody in the face, right? So the idea of someone going, hey, did you drink your energy fuel? You're like, screw you, dude. I just want to punch you right in the nose. Had a horrible race, right? It goes back to like we were saying, when you have a good race, how'd you do it? Most people can't tell you. When you have a bad race, they want to turn over every rock. Well, nutrition's the same way. You've got the morning of, 2 hours is the magical window. You need to keep in mind the inverse relationship between volume and intensity, which, by the way, I have so much respect for amateur racers because the pros are easy. You get a TV schedule. First moto starts at 10 a.m. The second moto is at 12 p.m., right, if you're in the 250 class. So it's pretty simple. You just do the math backwards from there. If your first moto is at 10, well, your last square meal is at 8. It gives you time to digest, absorb, and purge. So then you go to the starting grid without any chance of GI distress, gastrointestinal distress. Well, then wait a second. How do I get my electrolytes and my sugars topped off right before the moto? Hit some energy fuel, hit an energy gel, chase it with some water. make sure it's not more than 300 calories, right? So then you get to the day's over. Well, the clock starts. People go, it doesn't matter. The day's over. Let's go party. Let's celebrate. I understand. But you got to remember that when you hit your recovery today, that means tomorrow you're going to feel a little bit better, which allows you to get back on in the saddle again and get after it. Andrew, you doing that 90-minute zone two afterwards was a game changer because you flushed out all the lactic acid. You've obviously heated the tissue up again. That blood flow brings nutrients into there, which you just ate after you left, right?
Right.
So then when that's floating in your blood system, then you get the muscles activated. They start sucking those nutrients in, particularly if you did a mixture of carbohydrates to amino acids. Aminos rebuild the muscle. Any surprise why on the next day you're not sore? Of course not, because you moved and you fed it.
Well, and, you know, the other thing, too, is like, you know, I went from racing a motorcycle for 20s, which is, we spoke about this, like, it's essentially 10,000 squats, mm-hmm. right? The bicycle is a rotary motion. You know, that first 4 to 5 miles was absolutely hell.
Yeah.
Getting off a motorcycle, taking a shower, getting dressed and getting on a bicycle, and then just getting those legs to move in a rotary motion was, man, it was tough. Like, I couldn't even, I was stuck at like 14 mile an hour. I just go, man, this is terrible. Someone's going to be looking at me thinking I'm terrible. But as it went on, I got better and better and better. But I knew the benefit of doing it. I didn't want to do it.
This is where we get into the psychology of what's hard. And you just said it yourself, right? You're pedaling 14 miles an hour. This is the same guy that can hold, you know, 30 miles an hour for a 40K aero position, time trial, TT. Well, isn't that interesting? You were saying that the first 4 miles were hard. Define that hard versus a 3 hour ride that ends with a sprint for the last 5K, right? Everybody's got their definition of hard. You were talking about lifting weights, Brad, in the gym, right? It's hard. What makes it hard? Is it psychological or is it physical? And this goes back to when we're talking about building that framework. You have to build athletic durability. As a human being, our number one physical limiter will always be the ability to deliver oxygen. That's it. As soon as you go anaerobic, you don't think clearly, you can't move, the muscles can't contract, et cetera, et cetera. So when somebody asks me, what's the number one thing I should focus on? It's always going to be a tie, aerobic capacity or muscular strength. Until you can get enough consistency of those, sprint work will be 100% counterproductive. People go, bullshit, go do intervals and talk to me tomorrow about how sore you are. Go do a six, like you said, Brad, do a 30-minute bike ride in zone two. Don't smash yourself because you just came off of working all day.
Right.
And then do that for 6 days in a row and then go ride on the weekend and you tell me which one feels better. There's never been one person that comes back and said, this is a double negative. Anyone who does 30 minutes a day, zone two, melts body fat, enhances aerobic capacity, will always say on Saturday they feel better, 100% of the time, versus someone who does, let's call it a CrossFit session on Tuesday, maybe another one on Thursday, they feel like shit on Saturday, 100% of the time. And you go, no, not me, man. I'm Mr. CrossFit. I'll beg to differ. If I could be in your presence and I could go in and I could rub my thumbs in between your shoulder blades and you jump and you wince and I take you, get you on a foam roller and we run your quads because they're smoked from CrossFit compared to that spin that Andrew did, which ironically, did you hear what he said? Didn't have any muscle soreness today, even though he raced yesterday. Andrew and I didn't talk about it before today's conversation. You got to go where the evidence is at, not what somebody's over there rubbing their gums about because they got a weekend certificate. And now they're A certified and they're consider themselves a physiologist.
Right. Oh, for sure. I think that's one of the things that a lot of people make a huge mistake in is not checking your ego and not being kind to yourself when you need to recover and build the body back up to where it needs to be. If you have a bad race on Sunday, so like Matt locally race Sundays, Monday morning, you're like, that's it. I'm going back to the gym, blah, blah, blah. I do my 9 to 5 and then 6 o'clock, I'm doing heavy squats. I'm sprinting beforehand, blah, blah, blah. And like, that is like, so you're going to punish yourself for not being fit enough. That's not the right recipe. The right recipe needs to be, let's work on some mobility. Let's get back into the proper movements. And like allow our body to not just like, we're already depleted. You want to do that some more? You know what
this
I mean?
This is why I love my job, because people like you, people like the listeners, that fire in the belly that you're pissed on Saturday or Sunday's race, so you want to go smash yourself on Sunday. I want to harness that fire in the belly. And that's where knowledge becomes powerful. And you asked earlier, what's the first step? Well, I have to earn your trust first. So you're pissed that the results were dismal on Saturday or on Sunday. And you asked me legitimately, what should I do on Monday morning? It's probably the opposite of what you think it is.
Right.
Because that's that fire in the belly, disappointed. I love that. That's where, like, even today, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you guys and discuss these things. If the listener could pick up on the idea that aerobic capacity is the number one limiter of any athlete, because if you take somebody like Andrew that I've had the privilege of working 3 years with, let's go to the other end. We're going to get into some neuroscience of psychology. If Andrew's got a huge base of strength and he has a huge base of aerobic capacity, and then I ask him to do 10 by 1 mile, and we have something that we refer to as critical speed numbers. And the point is, it's not about the science of the number. It's about a number that you can consistently do all 10 intervals, and each interval gets progressively faster by just a smidge. Think about the confidence that he has as he teased. I didn't drop the droplets of sweat. He did. I may have given him the ideology of why are we doing 10 by 1 mile. Our goal is to negative split it with a critical speed number that's sustainable. We know what your heart rate zones are because they're accurate, because we've tested those within the last 6 weeks. You see how now it's not ever about me. It's about an athlete when he or she puts their helmet on. It's that helmet of confidence where it's like, okay, I'm fed, rested, and hydrated. I know what my critical speed numbers are. I know how long I can sustain that before I get tired. We refer to that as threshold of fatigue. I'm going to enjoy being on my dirt bike on Saturday, not because I smash myself. And then when all of a sudden we get into it's time to do the speed work, the athlete's both fast and can sustain it, they're a confident monster in the corner. Because at that point, I don't have any dog in the fight. What's my responsibility is I educated you before, you trusted it, you reaped the benefits on the backside. This is where we face fear of success. Oh gosh, how do I keep this incremental improvement? Keep doing what you did. Unfortunately, many people out there, trainer-wise, don't like to tell the athlete why they're getting the improvement, because they feel like that's the trump card to keep them coming back. I call bullshit. I say this to Andrew every time we're on the phone. I never want you to be dependent on me. My job is to empower you with knowledge. If I can put the nugget of knowledge in front of you and then you add your experience, that builds confidence and momentum. I feel sorry for your competition. Because if I take a pen and I drop that pen, why are you guaranteeing me that pen is going to drop out of the sky? What pulls that to the ground?
Gravity.
It's just a principle that exists, right? So I can't argue with the principles of nutrition and physiology. So we might as well embrace it. And that's what I love when I can give it. I mean, I spend 5-6 hours a day researching what's going on out at the Olympic Training Center, because what they say at the Olympic Training Center, they don't care what insignia is on your chest.
No.
They're there to get the best out of the human being. And I'll give you guys a real world example of this. It's kind of creepy. If you hear the word fructose and you go and you Google fructose, they'll tell you it's human poison. They'll tell you that nothing will cause cancer in a human being quicker than fructose. And right now, they're getting ready to launch a complete. In fact, there are some companies that already have it out there. I have my own sports drink. It's in a powder format known as Energy Fuel. That molecule of sugar, I can actually get it formulated utilizing fructose now. People go, why would you want to use fructose? Because it's been scientifically proven to absorb in the liver quicker, your liver feeds your brain, using fructose. Now, if you'd brought that out 10 years ago, you would be absolutely put in a cuckoo asylum. Because they're saying over here that fructose causes cancer. Now research has come through. Where do you think, right now we're seeing at a manufacturing level, where do you think that information was tested, tried, and put to the test? Back at the Olympic Training Center.
Yeah.
Well, that was 10 years ago. So Andrew, when we're taking Coca-Cola after a race and there was fructose in it, I didn't feel compelled to tell you that. We just talked about the idea that we need to reactivate the digestive enzymes in the belly, but it was about the not fearing fructose.
So I'm going to touch on something like that, but a little different.
Yes, sir.
Obviously, I've been hanging out with some cyclists, and they were avid Tour de France guys. So I heard a rumor, don't know how true this is, from a good source, that now, I got to try to explain this the best way I can to you from how I interpreted it. So they're taking carbon dioxide through a mask, because then when that's in the body thinks it's dying. So they're producing more blood, red blood cells. And that is the latest training phase I've heard from Tour de France. So I'm asking you whether you'd had heard anything about that.
I heard something about this about 2 years ago. And what's fascinating about it is the body will always adapt to try not to die. I know that sounds obvious, right? Mm-hmm. You go up into altitude, like when you look at Tomac being at Cortez, what'd you say, Andrew? That's 5,500 above sea level?
Yeah, it's like 55, I think, yeah.
So if you're at 5,500 feet above sea level, the amount of oxygen in the air progressively gets less and less. Therefore, the kidneys get indication, hey, we need some more red blood cells.
Right.
There's not enough oxygen in the air. Pardon me. When you look at the idea of the carbon dioxide and stuff like that, there's a little bit, I'll say, differing opinions, because carbon dioxide is more considered of a poison because it's a byproduct when you convert oxygen into carbon dioxide. But the body will adapt to try to get rid of that. So if the production of red blood cells is part of that, then I can see where that would be advantageous. The other side of it is, if you look at the idea of producing more red blood cells, usually the body has to be stimulated in a way where it has to be in need of oxygen. So it makes sense. If you put carbon dioxide in, if you think about it like as a percentage, think about when you're mixing your two-stroke oil, you know, it's an X to Y ratio. Well, if you just decided you're going to match the same amount of oil as if you've got a gallon of race fuel and you put a gallon of oil.
Yeah, you're one-to-one.
One-to-one, right? So if you're doing the carbon dioxide and triggering the body to think that there's a plethora of CO2, and here's the reason why it would work, is because there's no other physiological demands on the body at the same time. So I hate to use the analogy. If you watch a young kid who puffs on a cigarette for the first time, why do they cough? Because their body's telling them it's a carcinogen. It's not what the body can coexist with.
Right.
But because we're humans.
Your body not to cough it up.
Well, and that's what happens is our body gets to a point where it starts to recognize that our behavior is not going to stop. So therefore, you're able to tolerate, you watch somebody light up a cigarette, now it's been smoking for a year, they don't cough. That's because it's an adaptation. As morbid as an illustration is in a comparison.
Themselves.
Yeah, well, that's what's happening with the CO2, is if the body represents that there's not enough of a mixture of oxygen in the air, and all the CO2 is pouring in, but there's no other demands on the body, red blood cell count, based on the scientific studies, are saying that that would work. Now, here's the problem that I have with it, because it's like anything, right? You're going to have a young man that's going to hear this, and he's going to die of CO2 poisoning, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's that was more of a professional Tour de France. It's not something for the average guy to go suck on a tailpipe today.
Yep.
Obviously, it's controlled and it's filtered and all that sort of stuff. But
It's no different.
Like all things, though, in that case, then there'd also be athletes that become less and less sensitive to that training, so that you didn't there and you'd have to increase the amount of CO2 to create the same result later down the road. Like,
well, it's like a motorcycle, right? You go and you throw a big bore kit in. Well, you better beef up the chain and you better make sure the supporting staff is ready to take on what that power output's going to produce.
Right.
That's a danger with EPO. Right. If somebody hears, because if you look at EPO, EPO is just a byproduct of people who had cancer, that pharmaceutical company Procrit, they created it and they're like, hey, wait a second. They produced a substance that will notify the kidneys to produce more red blood cells. Red blood cells carry oxygen. So it's just a no brainer. And it's the same thing. Well, if a little of EPO is good, why not take five times the amount of EPO? Because now you've hooked your water hose up to a fire hydrant and it blows it out. CO2 poisoning is the real deal. I mean, people can die from CO2.
Right.
So like Andrew said, it's all about its relevancy. And I mean, if you've ever seen someone go through EPO cycles and stuff, I mean, it's, like same thing like blood transfusions. I mean, it's no game. I mean, we may talk about it over here lightly, but imagine going into somebody's office and, you know, they've already taken your blood out, which is already uncomfortable. Now they're going to pump that back in. And if you've talked to anybody who's done it, it's cold. So you literally can feel it. Like when you hear they say it's cold blood running through your veins, literally it's cold. It's almost, to me, it's like a morbid feeling. Yeah, I wouldn't want to feel ice cold blood going into my body. Cause you think about it, they store it in the refrigerator, right? So they're not going to like warm it up before they put it in. The thought of that to me would just be eerie, but it works for sure.
Well, Rob, I know, you've got a lot on your plate today as you do every day. So I think it's time for the Big MX Radio Racer's Mindset, 4 questions to finish off the podcast, starting things off with, what is something that that in the last calendar year you wish you did more of, or something you wish you did at all?
Say that question again. More, I did what is more
something,
of?
Yeah. What's something that you wish you, like, what's something that you are maybe are doing now that you wish you did more of like a year ago or over the course of the last year?
Yeah. For me, it's my guitar. If anybody's followed me, they know I've been trying to learn the guitar for a good 20 years. I love the YouTube because I got to where I could understand chords, but I couldn't understand how to read the music on when they transition from chord to chord. I'm very visual. So for YouTube, it's been a godsend. I have earmarked 30 minutes a day and I wished I was doing an hour a day because it's gotten better in the last year, but, I do need to wiggle some time in. I'm launching 3 new business projects, in January. And not an excuse, but an explanation. I always say there's a difference between the two. So if somebody takes you out in the first turn, it's not an excuse. That's an explanation. In this case, I've got some business things that we have to meet some milestone dates on because they have to be beta tested. So therefore I've kept it to 30, but I wish it was an hour.
Fair enough.
Love music.
Who is your biggest mentor? Who has been over the years?
Who's helped you the most over the years?
The reason why I'm pausing on this is I've been doing so much research on AI, and there's like 2 or 3 guys that I've been studying on AI. And it's the same thing like on the business development side of things, on how to configure, it's tied in together, the AI. So I would say, believe it or not, the community of YouTube would be my biggest mentor of the year. Because I have time allocated every day. I don't mind saying it publicly here. I try to get in the office every day by 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I've been doing that since January, and I try to do 3 hours of focused, uninterrupted work. And I do that 7 days a week.
Wow.
And it's all studying, and it's the YouTube environment is great. So I would say no one person that I could put my finger on. And you guys can respect this, you know, Brad, you're running your own business. Andrew, you've got a couple of businesses that you run. At the end of the day, it's, you know, a lot of parent teacher conferences going on. Mm-hmm. A lot of parent teacher conferences going on.
Are you an avid reader? And if so, what is a book that you've read recently that was impactful for you?
The most impactful book that I've read is The E-Myth. The E-Myth book. I am a horrible reader. My mom's, this is no disrespect to my mom. She's deceased and I love her to death, but she did smoke with me when she was pregnant. Mm. And so my short-term memory has always been a challenge. Even in school, I could read the same paragraph 12 times and I cannot tell you. And I'm fascinated with history. I can't read it. I can't retain it. I don't use it as an excuse. So audiobooks have been a godsend for me.
Okay.
But the E-Myth book would be definitely the book.
Perfect. And last one we have for you is, what's next for Rob Beams? You've been growing exponentially for a long time within this industry, contributing to it. And I'm always curious sort of what's on the horizon for you.
The first thing that you guys will see is the Complete Racing Solutions Certified Coaching Program. Nothing right. aggravates me more than you see these young guys come up through the sport. Like Rhino says, the sport requires so much of your attention. Education does get pushed by the wayside more by circumstances than by choice. And What I don't like is these kids have all this experience and all of these, you know, they're in the trenches. And to see them leave the sport and go into another industry, I'm really trying to do my best to have a higher retention rate of people who have gone through the sport. I don't want them to leave. I hear it all the time. Yeah, but I've only got a seventh grade education level. That's okay. You've got a lot of experience. So, and I don't want this to sound arrogant in the slightest bit, but I like to put my money where my mouth is. I couldn't find a sports drink that was based on intensity or duration, so we built it. So instead of seeing these kids go off, we've had an amateur development program for 14 years. So I have been very fortunate to see someone go from a 65 to an 85 all the way to a pro rig. So they've been exposed to some of the toolage. And I was like, well, wait a second. What if I put together literally a 2 and a 4 year degree that's specific to moto and off-road racing? So I've written an entire curriculum, and that curriculum is going to be literally, it's a 4 year degree. And you can go to whatever pace you want. So at the end of year one, it's like going to regular college, right? You get a little bit of, it's like going back to high school, right? You get kind of the fundamentals, but I'm not teaching, you know, how to dissect sentences. What I'm trying to teach people is how to get the foundation. Let's call it biology 101, nutrition 101, strength training 101. And at the end of those 4 years, you will have an undergraduate degree specific to being a human performance coach in the moto world.
Awesome.
What we're also continuing to grow is our Complete Racing Solutions network of facilities, which we currently have 27. We're looking to put one in Spain, put one in Poland. We have three, soon to be four, in Australia. We have two in the UK. We have them throughout the United States, because now think about it. Brad Gebhardt goes through. He's raced as a pro. He gets his CRS certification. What about placement? So now we have places throughout the United States, or if you want to go international, the athletes that are international that want to come over to the stateside, now we have an international development program. And then we have an additional component of that, which I'll be able to announce in January, where we're going to have a complementary system attached to that. So you'll know what to do on the bike. You'll know what to do off the bike. You'll have a degree and you'll have placement. And then therefore, when these athletes get into a program, they're not taking, I mean, can you imagine if Villopoto wasn't still in our sport? I mean, think about his experiences, the stuff that he did on a 250 that no one else has done before. I don't want that knowledge to leave. Not that Villopoto needs the money and wants to come work for us, but you know, it is cool. In the last year, I've had literally a dozen of the pros that have recently retired asking for a job. They want to become a riding coach, but they don't know about nutrition. And I'm like, cool. At least the vision, which is we're on year 13 of a 15 year build out. So what's coming down the pipe is the educational component on and off the bike, as well as the network of facilities. Our performance services, blood lactate analysis, continuous glucose monitoring, sweat rate, those are all going to be available through the coaches, through the facilities. So if Brad and Andrew own a facility in Timbuktu, Iowa, we can bring our performance services in there as an added value to be at that facility. That way that facility is making sure that they don't overtrain athletes. So it's our way of trying to keep our feet on the ground. Like we said at the onset of today's conversation, which I can't thank you guys enough for having me. It's the earlier we can get in front of people, whether it's directly with their parents and or they become teenagers, they become young racers. If we can keep one person from becoming overtrained, then I feel like we've made an imprint somewhere. And then hopefully it'll recycle back around.
That's awesome. Where can people reach you, Rob? You have multiple platforms that people can reach you. So let's just.
Yeah. The easiest is, obviously Coach Rob with 2Bs.com, or if you're already in the moto world, Complete Racing Solutions. We have a bunch of different training programs that are available there. Whether it's, you know, you want to do your own self-paced, where we have membership all the way up to custom programs. And we have a network of coaches that are starting to take on some of those one-on-ones. So if you're looking for customized nutrition on the bike, we do it all from A to Z. How much to ride, at what intensity, how frequent, and same thing, what to do off the bike, strength as well as cardio. We have nutrition and sports psychology. It's all in one program. There's no additional add-on fees. That drives me nuts. Andrew knows that's a pet peeve of mine. But, for just $19.99, we'll give you the mental trick.
Yeah, that's it. So, no, well, that's awesome. I really appreciate it. It's been a wealth of knowledge today.
Well, I appreciate it, guys.
Thank you enough.
It's been great. Well, maybe honestly, yeah. No, this went better than I thought it would. Not that I thought that it was going to be a bad podcast, but pleasantly surprised and encouraged with the possibility of having you on in the future. Can't thank you enough, Rob. This has been a lot of fun. I hope people to reach out to you, especially even if you're a weekend warrior who wants to just get more out of their race days, who like they're right now, like they're a little bit frustrated with how things are going when they get to the track, how like sort of just what that looks like. I think that being in better shape is not only a good life choice, but it also increases your enjoyment and your safety on the track, because exactly. When we're fit, we bend, we don't break. And hey, like I'm guilty as anybody of being a 4 or 5 lap wonder, and then coming off with my arms all like trying to shake out my hands. I would love to be able to do, 5 to 7 laps, and 25 minutes later to be, ready for some more. And I don't think I'm alone on that. So, yeah, use Rob as a great tool for that. And thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, thank you, guys. Hopefully we'll be able to get back together at World Vets and we'll do another one.
We might do a live one.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, boys. Peace.
Welcome to Best 42 in the land. All ages from kids up to grown men. Walk through the gates of the coal miner's daughter to make a point clearer than the creek water. Who's the best? Who's it gonna be? In Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the whispering. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Times this 1 week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do for 20 plus 2 out at the ranch. Golf carts, pit bikes, and rowdy fans. Play the national anthem and everybody stands. Smell the smoke from the two strokes riding by. The 30-second card's on its side.
It's time to get it on.
Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the wheel spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Line on the field. If you can put it all together 3 times, this 1 week of racing could